Well, happy feast. And thank you to the choir for all their work this feast. A lot of prep goes into all of the music and all the jobs here, and so a big thank you to everybody who's been a part of that. Hello to those on the webcast who are tuning in, and those listening in. Hope everybody's having a wonderful feast. Here we are at day six. Day six, and it's flown by, hasn't it? All right, I want you to imagine for a second, imagine that you're a lawyer, okay? So a few people wince. It's not, contrary to popular belief, it's not a sin to be a lawyer. We have some among us even. But imagine you're a lawyer, and imagine you get a phone call one day from your senator's office, and the person at the other end says, hey, the senator is considering you for, he'd like you to consider being a federal judge. He'd like to put your name forward, he'd like to nominate you to be a federal judge. You go, oh, well, I guess, maybe I could do that. The interesting thing in the United States is that the Constitution doesn't tell us any, it doesn't outlay any requirements for being a judge. Just says you need to be someone in good standing. It doesn't even require that you're a lawyer. You could be anybody. In fact, of our first 109 Supreme Court justices, we've had six more since, I don't know their backgrounds, but of our first 109 Supreme Court justices, so we're talking the top court in the country, of the first 109, 41 of them had no judicial experience at all. They'd never been judges before. Of our 17 chief justices that we've had through the history of our country, 17 chief justices, the very top, right? Nine of them had no judicial experiences when they were appointed. They were appointed to judgeship, had no judicial experience. Now, generally, they have some sort of law background, but that's not even a requirement. That's how judicial appointments, federal judicial appointments work in our country. So it's really not that uncommon for a lawyer somewhere to get a call from the senator's office saying, hey, I'd like to put your name forward. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 20 and verse 4. That's a natural segue. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 4. I don't think we've been here yet this feast in this particular chapter. Revelation 20 and verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them. And then notice the next thing that it says. And judgment was committed to them. It's right there in this key verse that we read about the millennium. It doesn't tell you a lot about these people, those who are the first fruits that are resurrected, that return with Jesus Christ, that rule and reign with him in his kingdom. It doesn't say a whole lot about them here in this verse, except that judgment was committed to them. So it's really not that distant of a metaphor to imagine yourself getting that phone call. Because when God called you, and he called you to be a part of his family and a part of this church, he called you knowing that there's a future judicial appointment, that judgment will be committed to you. That's part of our calling. We are called to be judges. And so you might sit and think about that and say, am I ready for this? And those who get that call saying, hey, we'd like to nominate you to be a judge, they've got to sit and weigh that too. Am I ready for this? And it turns out some people are not. But we have here in the United States, we have an institution called the Federal Judiciary Center, the FJC, the Federal Judiciary Center. And their primary task is ensuring the integrity and the quality of the judiciary in our country. They offer a multi-day workshop for people in this situation that get appointed to judgeship. It is called, in typical government fashion, Phase 1, orientation seminar for newly appointed district judges, which is a very riveting name. Nobody calls it that. Nobody calls it Phase 1 orientation seminar for newly appointed district judges. You know what they call it? They call it baby judge school. Baby judge school. And the curriculum at baby judge school is very interesting. They teach about your biases as a judge. They do emotional training because judging is a very emotional endeavor, whether you want it to be or not. They teach about common errors that judges make. And they teach you self-judgment. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. We'll start in verse 1. So here, Paul is writing to the church in Corinth, and he's got a little bit of an issue with them. He says, "Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints?" They were suing each other and taking each other to court. He says, why do you do that? Verse 2, "Do you not know that the saints will judge the world?" The saints will judge the world. "And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters?" He says, you've got to be able to judge the little stuff because you're going to be sitting in seats of judgment over the entire earth. Verse 3, "Do you not know that we shall judge angels?" And if you're like me, the first time you read that, you go, no, I did not know. I had no even inkling that we were going to judge angels. How did you know that, Paul? But he knew. God revealed that to him. I don't really even understand exactly what that means. There's some speculation about that. But he says, we shall judge angels. How much more things that pertain to this life? So that's what we want to look at today. Because Paul's expectation here is that the church should be judicially competent. That we should be able to judge at least the small things. At least the smallest matters. Because it's preparation. It's preparation for judging the entire earth. For judging the world as his saints in the millennium. That's his expectation. So we're ready. We're ready to do that. Let's turn over to Matthew 7. Because sometimes when we talk about judging, the first thing that will jump out in our minds, and especially in our society, is this idea that is a little bit misquoted and abused here in Matthew 7. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1 says, "Judge not that you be not judged." And so we have this idea in society like, well, don't judge me. Don't judge anything. Don't judge, don't evaluate. When in fact judgment is something that God has given to us as humans that is a pretty amazing capability. We're able to judge and discern things and look at things and evaluate things and draw conclusions in ways that no other creatures on this planet can. And so it's if we just stop here and we say judge not, we're taking this whole faculty that God has given us and we're saying, oh, I'm going to set this aside and not use it. When in fact God is expecting us to develop this ability to be able to judge and to judge well. So what does he mean here when he says judge not that you be not judged? He's clearly not saying don't judge anything, because in the next verse he says, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And in verse 6, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine. He's saying that you are going to have to make some judgments about things to know when the things that are holy should not be cast before swine. You're going to have to make those judgments. You're going to have to make some discernments. So he's clearly not saying here, don't judge anything. But he is talking about a certain category of judgment. We could turn to a number of scriptures where we see that condemnation is God's prerogative. God has the sole prerogative to condemn, to say, to judge finally, and to say, this person is worthy to be a part of my kingdom. This person is not. When we step into that territory, we're imposing on God's authority, and we're stepping into things that are his and that are not ours. So he's telling us here, don't do that. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. If you step into that territory, and you step into that condemnation territory, and you feel like it's fair for you to make those judgments, the implication is God will use that same criteria on you. And you and I don't stand much of a chance if God's using the kind of criteria that we would use when we make condemnations. Let's go over to Exodus chapter 18. Because here we see a class of judgments that we are expected to make, and that God's people throughout time have made and have been expected to make. There are lesser judgments. And so when we talk about judgment, we have to be able to discern between saying, this person is of no value, and this person is of value. That's not our prerogative to make. Exodus chapter 18 and verse 15. Here we see, we're going to jump into the middle of this story about Jethro. So Moses' father-in-law comes to him and sees him judging all the cases that people bring before him. And we're not going to read the part where he tells him, no, you got to split this up and have, you know, a higher tier of judges and then middle tier and lower tiers of judges. You know, spread this workload out so that people can judge and not, you don't have to sit and listen to all of them. But look at what Moses says in the context here. Exodus chapter 18 and verse 15. And Moses said to his father-in-law, here's why I do this. Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another. And I make known the statutes of God and his laws. These are the lesser judgments. God gave a whole set of statutes and judgments and ordinances for them to be able to judge their lives, to be able to discern and say, this thing is good, this is not good. And so many of those judgments are contrary to what we would think they ought to be. Some of the punishments to us feel very severe. Some of the other punishments are actually pretty light. And they're not what we would intuit. But it's what God lays out there. And so Moses says, my responsibility is to show them the judgments and the statutes of God. These are lesser judgments. This is the human domain. These are the things that we should be preparing to be able to do. Because we judge all the time. And we're not just talking about discernment. Discernment is sort of a part of judging. It's leading up to it. Discernment is being able to see and apply biblical principles and see, you know, different shades, one and the other, this thing and that thing, black and white, and in between. That's discernment. But judgment is being able to make an evaluation about something. And really, we do it all the time. We're not really allowed to, in some senses, in our society. We're not supposed to say certain things. And so we keep them in our brains, and we process them mentally. But we're always making judgments. We are. We judge conversations that we have. We judge disputes and arguments. We judge, you know, you might hear a rumor. You might hear gossip about something and make a judgment about it. It's obviously not what we want to be doing. We're confronted with a whole stream of media. Social media is just a constant stream of things for us to judge and evaluate. The news is like a constant stream of things for us to judge and evaluate. And we are making judgments constantly. So let's talk about how to do that. Let's talk about how to do that, because God expects us to be able to do it effectively. Here's kind of how normal human judgment works. We see and we hear something. something we perceive, something comes in. We decide whether or not we agree with it. We go, nope, don't agree with that. If it's a no, we jump right to sentencing. We pronounce a verdict and a punishment, and we're done. And then we move on. And it happens very quickly. And that's kind of how our brains work, right? That's how my brain works. That's how some of the research has shown that our evaluation processes take place. Sometimes we see something and we go, yes, I agree with that. That supports things that I already believe. I'm going to reinforce those beliefs. I'm going to take this idea and I'm going to stash it in my back pocket. And that's a good one. I like that one. I judge that to be true because it coincides with everything that I like. And we do this in all sorts of things. We even do this with our Bibles sometimes. We hear something, we think it agrees with what we understand about the Bible. Instead of going and checking, we just say, yeah, that's right. And so we're very quick to judge as humans. That process is missing a lot of steps when we look at biblical principles of how we ought to be judging. There are a lot of things missing out of there because it's not that fast. We don't just get to see and hear. Make a quick agree, don't agree, and then move on. There needs to be something more. There has to be more. So we want to look at some biblical principles of judgment. Biblical principles of judgment. Let's go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 19. 2 Chronicles chapter 19. The first step, I've labeled this as step zero. We'll start with zero. Step zero, because this is really more about how we're framing judgment. This is more how we think about judgment when we get to it, when we approach it. We have to frame judgment with godly fear. Judgment has to be framed with godly fear. 2 Chronicles chapter 19 and verse 4. The subheading here in my Bible says the reforms of Jehoshaphat. So here's King Jehoshaphat, and he's coming and he's instituting some reforms. And notice the very first thing that it tells us that he does here. Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again among the people from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim and brought them back to the Lord God of their fathers. Then he set judges in the land throughout all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city. There's something a little bit millennial about this. You have a king who is coming and he's sort of resetting the country. He's reforming and he's saying, we're going to set things in order here. And so the first thing he does is he commits judgment to a group of people. He establishes judges because justice is important in setting up a kingdom. And so he's setting judges in place. And then notice what he says to them. Verse 6. And he said to the judges, take heed to what you are doing. Take heed. Pay attention. This is not some light thing. You're stepping into something pretty serious. Take heed to what you're doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in judgment. He's with you in it if you're stepping into it in that mindset. If you're thinking about the fact that, you know, I am going to be a judge someday, I'm called to this. This is part of what we will be doing. This is part of what we're celebrating here at the Feast of Tabernacles. He says, take heed to what you're doing because you're not judging for man. You're not just making a judgment call for yourself. You are a representative of Jesus Christ, wherever you are, and his kingdom. And so when you make a judgment and you make an evaluation of some sort, that should reflect him. That should reflect his principles, his ideas, his judgments, precepts, statutes. It needs to show those things. You don't judge for a man. You don't just judge for you. You judge for the Lord. Now therefore, verse 7, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. That has to, you know, you can almost think of that as sort of sitting on you, weighing on you. That awe of God, when you step into that role of judgment, the awe of God should be weighing heavily on your shoulders. Because you're judging for him. Therefore, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take care and do it. For there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no partiality, nor taking of bribes. So you have to put on that fear, put on that awe with your future role in mind. One of the former directors of the Federal Judiciary Center, his name's Jeremy Fogel. He had this to say about judging. He says, it's really hard to be humble when you're a judge. Everybody's kowtowing to you. You're wearing the robe. Everybody's calling you Your Honor. A judge can make huge mistakes and still fool himself into thinking he's doing great. So you have to step into this role, that humility, with that awe, with that fear. The awe and the reverence that people pay a judge, that should be exceeded by the awe and the reverence that that judge has for the person they report to. In our case, right, our awe and our reverence for God, that should far exceed any awe or reverence that anybody will ever show you now or in the future because of that position that you have, because of the judgments that you are to make. That respect, that deference that people will give a judge, they acknowledge that often it's a false deference. It's a false sort of respect that a judge will be paid because of the position they're in. But as a judge, even in the small things, when we are judging the smallest things in life, we have to put that mentality on, and we have to think about it from the perspective of the fear of God, saying, I have to make this judgment in preparation. I have to make this judgment in awe of God and his law, his principles, not just based on my feelings, my thoughts, my limited understanding. So that's step zero. Once we're in the right mindset, there are a few more things that we can add on to that. The next thing we can evaluate really goes back to what we were talking about of judging not. Right? We can ask ourselves, should I be judging this? Should I be judging this thing? Is this even in my court? Is this something that I should evaluate or not? There are a few different things that we judge. Here's some examples. Because I'm sure everybody's done this. You've been walking through Walmart, and there's that bad mom, right? And she's yelling at her kid, and that kid is, you would not want anything to do with that kid, right? Wouldn't want that. And so we naturally just go into judgment. But that's not really our domain. That's not at all our domain, right? Maybe you're seeing her on her worst day. Maybe her kid's got something going on. Maybe he's lovely, normally. And you're just seeing all this. We don't need to judge that at all. That's not in our court. We don't need to make that evaluation. How about when one of your friends sends you an article from sketchynewssource.com? Right? That we should absolutely judge sometimes. If it's going to impact our thinking, if we see something like that, if we have something confronting us that we know, this is getting in there, this is getting in my head, I do need to judge this. I need to evaluate this. This is in my court. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes there's some crazy thing that somebody's going to send you on sketchynewssource.com, and you're going to go, this isn't worth my time of day. Paul told Timothy, don't even bother with these foolish disputes and this silly stuff. Don't even give it the time of day because it's not worth it. We have other things that we need to be worried about, and those things are not it. Another easy one to judge is when we hear that rumor about anything. You hear that rumor, oh, what's that? Oh, well, here's what I think. Let me tell you what I think. And agree, disagree, pronounce, sentencing, done, move on. But that's not really our domain either. And the Bible has clear principles on that. We shouldn't hear gossip. We shouldn't listen to it. That's not in our court. We can shut that down, kick it out, next case. Something like my children's behavior. That is definitely there for me to judge. I am the primary judge of that kind of thing. Right? That's completely within my court. And so I do need to evaluate that. You know, when the kids come to you and say, he hit me, well, now, okay, court's in session, here we go. And let's talk through this. That's entirely in my domain. But the point here is, we need to be asking ourselves, should I be judging this thing at all? And sort of the two criteria we can look at. Am I in condemnation territory? We talked about that. Am I in that domain where maybe I'm getting to condemnation and saying, this person, because of all these things, is worthless? That's dangerous territory. That's not our territory. The other thing is, do I have a responsibility? Do I have a decision? Do I have an action? Is there some follow-up? Is there something in my thinking that I need to change that's hinging on judgment? Is there something in my court that hinges on this judgment? And if there's not, just move on. We don't have to make that judgment. And it's so freeing to say, I don't have to judge that. That's not for me. I don't need to worry about that. It takes a whole load of things off your plate you can just not worry about. And we can think on the things that Mr. Keller's talked about at the Bible study the other night. We have more time for those. So should I be judging this? That's sort of our first question. Here's another sort of next step to sort of slow things down, make good judgments. What information do I need in order to judge well? What information would I really need in order to make this judgment and to make it well? Let's go to Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 17. Proverbs 18 and verse 17. There are so many cool ideas that are represented right here in this verse. Proverbs 18 and verse 17 says, the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. Until his neighbor comes and examines him. I used to, in my head, my paraphrase of this was, first one to plead his cause seems right until another one comes along and tells his side. But there's a little nuance in there. It's not that. It's until his neighbor comes along and examines him. It's a cross-examination is what's happening here. You have a witness who's giving their testimony, and then you have a cross-examination. You have somebody from an opposing point of view who's going to bring out another facet and then engage in dialogue with that person and bring out more information. This scripture tells us that there is a lot of hidden information that we don't know. When we hear something, when we have something that comes into our court and we say, okay, this is for me to judge, there's a lot of hidden information. There's a lot we don't have. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to realize, I don't know. I really don't know. It's really neat that you may have heard of this idea of this sort of default to truth theory. It's been popularized in recent years. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book where he talked about it. There was some previous research that was done. The idea is that when we hear something, our default response to hearing that is to believe it. Humanly, that's the belief. And they've done all sorts of research about it. But that's what this scripture is saying. This scripture told us about default to truth theory a long time ago. It says, the first one to plead his cause seems right. The first thing you hear is going to sound right. Until you get the cross-examination. And then more information is drawn out. And then we learn and we understand. It's uncovered. There has to be more that comes out of it. So when we're thinking about what information would I need in order to be able to judge this thing correctly, right, this is the spot to start with. I don't know. I don't know. Because it's probably right. If we start there, we're in safe territory. Because we probably don't know. But we can begin with I don't know. And then we can say, well, what would I need to know? What pieces of information should I bring in here so that I can have a full and complete understanding? What would I need to understand? Sometimes you'll get to that step and you'll realize there's so much more information here that I would need in order to make a good judgment that this is no longer my judgment to make. I can't do it. I can't get all of that information. And you bow out of making that judgment. Because sometimes, humanly, that's where we are. God's not always there. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. God's never there. Because God can do what we can't do, but will be able to do when he entrusts us with judgment. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 5 says, therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the hearts. God brings the hidden things out. He can do that in ways that we can't. But it's showing here that this is what a good judge, a righteous judge does. Brings the hidden things out. Brings the information out. When you think about a judge sitting in like a family court, and they do so much listening and asking, well, what about this? Okay, well, tell me about this. And they just sit and absorb information and try and get as much perspective as they can. As judges, we need to do more of that, more listening. Start with I don't know. And then consider, what should I know? What should I know? Step three. That was step two. Step three. You can start turning over to Leviticus 19 and verse 15. Leviticus 19 and verse 15. Step three is to ask ourselves, what are my personal biases? What are my personal biases? Because we have them. We all do. We all have some kind of bias. It's in there. And so God warns about that in judgment. Leviticus 19 and verse 15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. He's saying, you don't get to go either way. No, God, in this instruction here, he doesn't just side with one side. You know, later he talks to Israel and condemns them for oppressing the poor. They did a lot of that. But here he tells them, he says, don't be partial to the poor in judgment. And don't give favor to the mighty. Because we're going to have some biases one way or the other that make us sort of feel toward one or the other, respect one or the other. You're going to have something there. And he says, don't let bias turn into partiality. You can't let your personal biases make you partial, because God is not partial. And it can't go either way. You can't go toward the poor or toward the rich. He says, do no injustice in judgment. Back in 2 Chronicles 19, where Jehoshaphat sets up his judges, notice another thing that he tells them, that he reminds them of. 2 Chronicles 19, verse 7. Let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take care and do it. Because there is no iniquity with the Lord. There's no injustice in judgment in what he judges. There's no iniquity with the Lord our God. And no partiality, nor taking bribes. There's no partiality. There's nothing that sets God to favor the rich, to be partial toward the poor. And since we judge for him, since we will judge for him, We can't be partial either. But bias can make us partial. We have to admit our biases in order to produce better judgment. This is a quote from a book called Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke. She talks about decision making and some of these evaluation things. She's talking about how we form abstract beliefs, how we form our beliefs about things and our understandings about things. And you know, we like to think that we hear something and then we evaluate it carefully, decide whether it's true or false, and then accept or reject it. But here's what studies have shown. Here's how it works. She says, we actually form abstract beliefs this way. First, we hear something. Then, we believe it to be true. Again, this is that default to truth stuff. This is what Proverbs 18 told us. We believe it to be true. Then, only sometimes, later, if we have the time or the inclination, we think about it and vet it, determining if it's true or false. That's how most people form beliefs. We hear it, we believe it, and then maybe, somewhere down the road, we revisit it. Hopefully, before we've made it too much a part of our thinking and our way of life, that it becomes really hard to reject it. But that's how most of us form beliefs. And that's how we get our biases. They become sort of a part of our thinking and a part of who we are. So we have to be really honest about what our biases are. And we have to make sure that when we're going to go make some judgment about something, we're not letting our bias make us partial. That's the danger, and that's what he's telling us here. Step four. We're going to collect testimony. We'll call it testimony. It's not always actually verbal testimony from someone. Sometimes it is, but not always. Often when we're making a judgment, even a small judgment, we have some sort of information, some sort of testimony that we then have to go accept. You know, we have to think about the things that we feel like we might need to know, and then we actually have to go out and find that information. We collect the testimony. Go over to Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15. Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. Two or three witnesses, it says. Can't just be one. Testimony of one is not sufficient. It has to be two or three. We have Proverbs. There are three different Proverbs that talk about the multitude of counsel in a different context, right? When we're seeking input on making other types of decisions. It says, go find a multitude of counsel. Here, in the legal setting, it's saying, you have to have multiple witnesses. You have to have testimony from multiple sources because they're going to bring different things to light. Because there's hidden information. Because we have biases. And so we have to go out and we have to find those other sources and admit those. Paul quotes this scripture when he's writing to Timothy. And he tells him, he says, don't hear an accusation against an elder except by the mouth of two or three witnesses. Don't hear it. Don't even give it the time of day. That's not a judgment that comes into your court. He's saying there has to be multiple points of input before we can make a judgment about anything. We especially need to find that testimony that counters our biases. That's the really tough one. That's the hard one. Because it's easy to go find the information that confirms our biases. Oh yeah, here's this one, here's this. See, now I've got 3 points. And actually what we're doing is we're building a case, right? We act like the lawyer. Like, oh, I'm going to make my case. I've got all these data points. Here's my information. That's what a lawyer does. A judge has to collect from all the different sources. A little over a year ago, I used Google News for keeping up with my news, and you know, if you click on enough religious articles, they're like, oh, you must want these news sources. You must want more of this kind of information. You must want everything from this extreme. I thought, why is this is all feeding into my news cycle? I'm getting more and more and more of one perspective. And so I went out and I found a news source that was kind of the other side of things, so that I could see, well, what's the other information? What's coming in from that side of the world? And it's eye-opening. It really is, because you get another perspective, and you don't agree with everything. And the point isn't that you're to agree with all of this testimony, but the point is that you hear it so that you can understand. You can understand different points of view. So we have to do that. We have to collect testimony. Step five. We have to weigh the heart. We have to weigh the heart. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 16. Some of you know where we're going with this. 1 Samuel chapter 16. So here's Samuel. He's going out to anoint the next king of Israel. And all these strapping young men, these sons of Jesse, come before him. Ah, this is the one. 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 7. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or his physical stature. Don't just look at the things that you're seeing that come into your senses. Because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Sometimes we look at all the facts on the table. We look at the things that we can see, and we make some sort of evaluation. If you go read some judicial history, it's riveting. No, it actually really can be. It can be really interesting. But the stories that are really interesting and really compelling are where a judge sees through a situation and identifies there's a heart issue here that's underneath all of this stuff. There's a heart issue, and is able to address that issue when they're making a verdict, when they're pronouncing sentencing. Those are the things that we're really trying to get at. We have to weigh the heart. Now the problem is, Jeremiah 17 verse 9. If you go over to Jeremiah 17, 9, some of you know it. It's a memory scripture. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? He's telling us there's a problem here. Humanly, we only have these human tools. We don't have God's tools yet. We don't have the tools to be able to see and discern the hearts. We just have human tools. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, he says. God can do it. By his Spirit, there are things that we can discern and we can understand. We don't get a full and deep understanding of the heart, though. We really don't, because we are still working with these physical tools. We have limitations. We can judge fruits. We can sort of look at the fruits of things and say, based on these fruits, here's what I think ought to be applied. But we don't know the hearts. So God tells us in Micah 6, 8, he says, love mercy. Because we just don't know. Right? There are just too many times where we can't weigh the heart. So he says, if you have to, he says, do justly, right? He doesn't say love justice, right? And enforce it down to the, you know, the nitty gritty. He says, do justly, but love mercy. When you weigh the heart and you realize you just don't fully understand it, you have to love mercy. And that has to factor into the judgment that you make. then, now after you've done those things, after you've walked through some of these principles, then you get to sentencing. Now you get to pronouncing a verdict and sentencing. But it's a long process. Our normal process, our normal human process is to pretty much jump straight to verdict, sentencing, done. But there are a lot of things that we have to do along the way that God says are factors in biblical judgment. Here's an article from the American Bar Association. All sorts of interesting sites out there with great information about the law. Four federal judges talk about their journey to the bench. Here's what a couple of them said. They said, this is Judge Theodore McKee. He said that they were asked, what surprised you most about becoming a judge? He says, sentencing was very difficult. The emotional difficulty of sentencing is taxing. Judge Joseph Greenaway, nothing quite prepares you for sentencing. Being humble is a great trait to have. Now, we jump to it quickly, and we can, you know, we sentence things in our mind very fast. But if you're actually doing it the way that a judge does it, this is how it feels. It's going to feel taxing. It's going to be emotionally draining. It's not going to be rewarding to sentence somebody, to pronounce verdict and sentence. We sometimes sentence and think, all right, yeah, that's what it should be. We feel good about that. They say it's taxing. I mean, can you imagine being the person who has to sit in the seat and you make a decision? Does this person get 5 years or 10 years in prison? That's your decision. A judge gets to pronounce that. They're given guidelines, but they choose the number. What if you had to choose the number? Here's how many years you're going to be in prison. Boom. They say it's taxing. It's draining. Sentencing is not something that we should jump into. So before we get to that point, before we get to the place of pronouncing a verdict and thinking about what the follow-up is going to be, we have to slow this all way down. Walk through those steps. Collect the data, right? Then when we have information, when we have testimony, when we've figured out how to put aside our biases, our partiality, then we can get to that place of digging into God's law and saying, here are the principles, here are the statutes, here are the judgments, here's the restitution that should be made, here's the follow-up. That's when it gets applied. But only after we've slowed it all way, way down. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 as we start to wind down. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 31. Because I know you're all thinking, all right, let's get out and do some judging. Let's go at this. I'm so excited. We know judgment, 1 Peter 4:17 says the time has come for judgment to begin with us, at the house of God. It begins with us. It starts with us. Right? We like to look outwards and make our judgments. Oh, look at all these things I can judge. Right? But it has to start with us. That's where God is starting. He is starting with his church. And he is judging us now. So Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 31. This is in the context of Passover, where some are getting sick and not doing well at Passover. And he's saying it's because you're not keeping it appropriately. And here in the middle of it, he says, if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. If we judge ourselves, if we can do that now, if we can make those judgments, if we can take this process and turn it and apply it to ourselves first, and start changing who we are and what we are, right, then God doesn't have to make those judgments and those pronouncements and corrections because we're already doing it. We have to start with us. We have to start with ourselves, start with our person, start with our house, start with whatever our sphere of responsibility is, and start judging there. And then we can start practicing outward a little more. Michael Lewis, the author, he has a podcast about all sorts of interesting things in the judgment space called Against the Rules. And one of those episodes is called Baby Judge School. And after interviewing and talking to people who have been involved with it and judicial preparation, he says, the general idea of Baby Judge School is to turn judges into people who can judge themselves. To turn judges into people who can judge themselves. Judges who are able to, in the moment of pronouncing judgment, are able to evaluate themselves, judge themselves, know their biases, their tendencies, know that maybe they're a little cranky because it's almost time for a lunch break. Realize that this particular case has gotten them real fired up about something, and recognize that they need to maybe take a break, tone it down, slow it down, so that they can make a good judgment. The goal of that school is to make people that can judge themselves so that they can make better judgments. And God's telling us here, we need to be the kind of people that can judge ourselves so that we can make better judgments. Pay attention to all of the judgments that you're required to make in a day. There are a lot of them. Slow them down. Apply these principles. Apply biblical principles. Because you and I are being prepared. And judgment will be committed to us. For now, we're in baby judge school.